Welcome to College Land, a podcast featuring untold stories from higher education. I'm Nan Enstead from Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Lisa Levenstein in Greensboro, North Carolina. We're here to explore life inside our nation's colleges and universities and to track some of the major changes that are happening.
We do this by sharing stories about the people who work there. Today on our show, we will tell you about why we started College Land and share an interview that I did with Malia Jones from the University of Wisconsin, who is one of the founders of the public health advice column on social media called Dear Pandemic. Dear Pandemic began as a Google Doc that Malia shared in March with friends and family about how to respond to the pandemic. The doc went viral on Facebook, and now Dear Pandemic is a team of 13 scientists, public health experts, and nurses from 12 different campuses that answers questions daily for over 50,000 followers.
We'll end with a segment we call Report Card, in which we grade and give comments about important happenings in the world of higher ed. If you have an idea for this segment or for any of our segments, we want to hear from you. Our email is collegelandpod@gmail.com. You can also reach us on Facebook or Twitter at collegelandpod. Now, on to our show.
Lisa, we've known each other for a long time. We're both professors, both at public institutions, but really different ones. I'm at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You're at University of North Carolina, Greensboro. But this College Land podcast was really your idea, and you wrote me in on it. Tell people why you wanted to do this.
Well, I love listening to podcasts, particularly those that introduce us to people doing interesting things in environments I'm not familiar with. Higher education is definitely its own weird world with its own norms and customs. And I think it's filled with fascinating people working on all kinds of projects.
You sold me on this idea pretty fast because I realized that talking to the many kinds of people who work in universities will also reveal how colleges are connected to the broader society. We wanted to think about how colleges fit into their communities and into public life in general.
Our first three episodes are such good examples of these connections. We're talking to people whose work is shaping our experiences of the pandemic and immigration and also voting.
And I'm just going to say, they are cool interviews, listeners. You're going to want to hear them.
There's one more thing, though, and probably the most important thing. We felt an urgency to start this podcast now because higher education's actually in trouble. We've had decades of cuts that have imperiled the workers at many public institutions in particular. And these cuts have also caused tuition to skyrocket, which has been really hard for our students. And then the pandemic hit.
Exactly. We have been seeing programs and even universities closing. Humanities, which had already been targeted, are now being eliminated. And you and I really share a worry about the future of higher education. There's a lot to criticize about universities, and we are down for that. We're going to do some of that. We are not a university PR office, but we wanted to bring out what's good at universities and envision what could be better. Let's not forget, for example, that the numbers of working class students and students of color has been growing over the past couple decades at branch campuses like UW-Oshkosh or where you teach, Lisa, at UNC Greensboro.
Yeah, talking with you, Nan, it's really helped me think about the importance of college campuses as sites of upward mobility for working class people. I've been noticing how many of the people I come into contact with in my daily life are not from elite backgrounds. You know, that's not true only about the students, but also of the faculty and staff.
Yeah, I come from a family that was practically religious about public higher education. My parents met at Winona State Teachers College in Minnesota, and my dad graduated from the University of Minnesota, and so did I. My parents deeply believed that everyone who wanted to go to college should have that opportunity. And my dad was only able to go to college because of his military service, so he never took that for granted. The rising cost of college really upset him because he was afraid that college would go back to being only for rich kids. So yeah, I'm a professor, and of course I care about higher education because that's where I have spent my life, but it's also in my DNA to want to talk about where college fits into our collective life as a country.
I grew up in Canada and I came to the United States to go to college in 1990. I stayed for grad school and have spent my career working in U.S. higher education. But you know, Nan, I feel sometimes like I'm still learning new things about the U.S. system. There are so many things that have seemed really unique and strange to me coming from a different country. An example is that to apply to colleges in Ontario, where I lived, there weren't any standardized tests or even essays to write. We filled out a single form, and on that form, we listed our classes and our grades, and that was the entire application process. And even though I've lived and worked here for decades, my Canadian background means that I have a really different viewpoint on what's worth valuing in U.S. higher ed, and also just what our institutions could be in the future.
So the idea behind this podcast is that the best way to try to make sense of what universities do and how the campus landscape is changing is to hear about it directly from the people who are working there.
Plus, we'll also weigh in with our own experiences and commentary. Think of us as your intrepid guides into a strange and vast land.
If you know someone working on a college campus that you'd like to see us cover, or if you're associated with a college campus and have your own story to tell, we want to hear from you. Email us at collegelandpod@gmail.com or reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter, collegelandpod. We're kicking off today with an interview that I did with Malia Jones, an associate scientist in health geography at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. She is co-founder and editor-in-chief of Dear Pandemic, the popular public outreach account on social media. When I first heard about Malia Jones' work on Dear Pandemic, I was so struck by how it epitomizes some of the things that we're interested in for college land, in that it spans many, many universities. The scientists all come from different universities. It's a network of people cooperating across the country. Everybody but one person is from a university. And it really arose as this kind of effort to respond to the moment and to the fact that people really didn't know what to do during the pandemic. They didn't know what advice, they didn't know who to trust, really. We see an epic government fail at kind of bringing us, you know, trustworthy information in a approachable way. And Dear Pandemic stepped into that gulf. So I'm excited to share this interview with you all. Welcome, everybody, to College Land. Our guest today is Malia Jones, who is an associate scientist in health geography at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Applied Populations Laboratory. She is co-founder and editor-in-chief of Dear Pandemic, a super popular public outreach campaign on social media. Malia, welcome to College Land.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I have just been fascinated by Dear Pandemic as this media project for a while. I'm a follower, and so I know that Dear Pandemic is, you know, made up of 13 PhD and MD trained women from a variety of disciplines in the sciences and social sciences.
Yep.
And that you guys curate COVID-19 content for the greater good. That's one of your mottos on the Facebook page,
yep,
which I love.
That is our mission.
That's your mission. Cool. And you're like wildly popular. 50,000 followers on Facebook?
Almost. Yeah, we're coming right up on 50,000 followers on Facebook. And it has been growing steadily since day one. We launched on March 13th. So we have been there on Facebook and also on Instagram and Twitter since the very beginning.
It's incredible. And now you have a Spanish language branch?
We do. Yeah, we have a mirror site called Querida Pandemia that is a Spanish language version of Dear Pandemic. And we're trying to reach, Spanish speaking, mostly U.S. residents, but people around the world as well with factual, well-curated scientific COVID info.
It's amazing. And your all-volunteer team of scientists and social scientists are called the Nerdy Girls.
That's right.
Which I love.
One of our readers gave us that name, actually. Do you know this story? So this all started back in very early March because, you know, before the pandemic, I worked in a related academic space. And I, you know, I had some thoughts about what I was seeing unfold on the world stage in late February, early March. And I got back from a vacation with my husband on March 1st. And at that point, it was really clear that we had a pandemic on our hands, that, you know, it had escaped any kind of containment measures that were attempted, and that we were all going to be facing COVID-19. I did not forecast exactly what that was going to look like very well, but I wrote this email to my friends and family members that was just kind of my informed opinion about what was happening. And that email went totally viral. It ended up on Facebook and Reddit and Twitter, and ultimately was published as an opinion piece in USA Today National. And I was getting a ton of media attention, because at that time, that was the first week of March, and there was just, you know, no information out there. It seemed like there was just a complete void.
There was, you know, and I was on Facebook one night doom scrolling, you know, and I came across this post where somebody's like, you know, here's some like really practical advice on what to do right now and what to believe right now. And so I read it and I was like, this is so helpful. It was about hand washing. It was about, should you be worried about, you know, like what you should be worried about, what you shouldn't be worried about, how to respond to various things. And I got down to the bottom and it's like, wait, Malia Jones, I know Malia Jones. This was on somebody's site who didn't know you. And, you know, I just know you, you know, slightly through work. And I was like, oh my goodness, I know this person. So I know how viral it was. And then, yeah, it's been amazing to watch this just explode every time I turn around now. And I've been, you know, a Facebook fan from the beginning, and just like watching every time I turn around, I see some more coverage and you guys are out there, in ever more visible ways. So
it has been quite the ride. Yeah. So real early on, I reached out to my longtime collaborator I study vaccine hesitancy. That's a big part of my research agenda. And I have been collaborating with Allison Buttenheim at Penn for years. I think almost a decade on that work. She's a behavioral economist and she studies vaccine hesitancy from a little bit of a different angle. So anyway, I reached out to her. We kind of laughed about how we were both famous for our comments on Facebook and decided to coordinate our comments and put them, and she made a decision to put them on a public page instead of on our personal pages and called it Dear Pandemic. And then one of our mutual acquaintances said, I don't know what you're listening to. I'm just going to follow those nerdy girls. And so that's how we became those nerdy girls. And then we started reaching out to other people who, mostly in our personal and professional networks, who were also, you know, being fairly public about their thoughts and opinions and, you know, what they saw as factual science about what was coming up in the pandemic, and added to the team from there. And so, yeah, now we're 13 women, and it's just grown steadily. You know, every day seems like a new thing. It's been a real growth opportunity for me and for, I think, everybody else. I mean, when I look back at those early posts, it's kind of, in some ways, amusing how amateur hour it was compared to what we're producing now, which I think is really good.
Yeah. Well, and the number alone is amazing, like 600 essays on your website. It's just this incredible treasure trove of information on almost every kind of facet. And that's one of the things that I think is really interesting, is the range of information that you cover. It's not just epidemiology, what are the facts? It's like you've got all these experts, nursing, family medicine, immunology, economics, health policy, demography, like all these different fields and people weighing in with their different kinds of expertise. And how did you end up sort of taking such a big, wide approach to what kind of knowledge to put out there?
You know, it happened a little bit organically, because we did start off by just reaching out to the people in our own personal circles, professionally speaking. And I work in a very interdisciplinary way. I mean, my work is inherently right in between geography and public health and demography. You know, I work in all those spaces. So I, and you know, the people in my network are also pretty interdisciplinary. And so when we started reaching out to folks, we ended up with a fairly wide variety of different academic points of view. Many of us are social scientists, but we do have an immunologist, a real bench scientist, and also we have a number of clinicians on our team. Allison is situated in a school of nursing, and so that's the tie-in to the clinical side. But it's really been, I think, it's a big part of the magic of the team that we have and what we can produce, because we really can. You know, we had a day this past week where we had two really good posts about, one was about labor statistics and the she session, women leaving the workforce in order to manage their kids at home largely. And the second one was explaining what an mRNA vaccine is at the molecular level. You know, it's just incredible breadth. And I think in each of those spaces, we can go into a lot of depth too. But I will say that the popularity of our posts, I think the reason that we have kept growing is because we don't just do like science explainers. Our most popular posts are all super practical. Like people, they could almost have been in Good Housekeeping magazine. I mean, people want to know stuff like, how many times can I wash a mask before it wears out? You know, just like, great, I'm so glad somebody understands mRNA, but I need to know how to live my life.
It's really the one-stop shop for all of your pandemic needs, you know? It really is. Like, who do you ask? Ask Dear Pandemic. And it's a brilliant, like, model for creating this kind of outreach. I mean, you've talked before about that we have an infodemic going on right now. What is an infodemic, and how has the larger sort of context of information shaped your guys' mission?
Yeah, WHO coined this word, I think back in April or so, the infodemic. And it's this idea that part of the challenge of managing a pandemic in an age where information is both very easy to access and also very hard to vet in terms of, you know, there's no one in control of the truthiness of the information that circulates on social media. And so we're challenged with this situation where we have to ask people to engage with good science, but there's a lot of bad science and non-science out there that's competing. And in some ways is more appealing in terms of, you know, its viralness or its potential to get a lot of eyeballs. And so that information overwhelm, they call it the infodemic. It's the, you know, people have so much information that they don't, they can't weed through it. They can't sort out what's true and what's not. And so we made it part of our mission to help curate the overwhelming amount of information, you know, get to the nuts and bolts of what's really important, help translate it in a practical way so that people can take what we know and what we're learning and live their lives in a way that is safer and helps control the pandemic. And we also do a lot of, you know, just translating the hard science stuff too. When we learn something new, like, you know, for example, that mRNA vaccine post, that's something that most of us have no previous familiarity with. Nobody knows what that is. And so just explaining that so people understand what it is.
Yeah, in a way that is very approachable and accessible and not like you have to, you know, keep looking up words in, you know, Googling different words. It's all like kind of broken down in this way. Yeah, I think it's like, you get this sense of security. It's like, I know these nerdy girls. I know they do their homework. I know they like facts, but they're also like ordinary people. They're like also navigating these very same issues that they're writing about and talking about. And so I think there is something that you very successfully have kind of created, like captured the good part of our viral social media, you know, by being super approachable.
I agree with you. That's the magic of it. I have joked that we accidentally invented the unicorn, and we get a lot of questions from other academics that are like, how did you do that? What was the plan? And I mean, I have to admit, there was no plan, and I don't know how we did it.
Uh-oh, because that was going to be one of my questions. Scratch.
We are
scratch
totally
that
building
question.
This plane while we're flying. But it is, I hear that comment a lot, that people say that they feel better, that they feel reassured, you know, that one of the things that they're getting from us is that they trust, they know they can trust us because we are, we have made this commitment to the facts and, you know, don't spin them. And also that we're real human beings who have to sometimes, like, you know, drop off a Zoom call to teach spelling to a fifth grader suddenly, or, you know, whatever else is happening in 2020 problems.
Yeah. Well, I want to follow up on this, but I also want to first talk about the kind of the bigger public context, because I think one of the things that's so distressing to so many people, but it's hard to actually not participate in it, and it is how politicized all of the information circulating in kind of the mainstream media is, you know, and that I feel like has created such a epic fail in our society. Yeah. And, you know, like in that sense, I guess I'm just curious about how your perspective on that whole phenomenon, which is really quite distinct about this, like our moment, right, is that, and our country, and how we're dealing with it. Do you guys talk about this?
We talk about it all the time, all the time. So we made a commitment that, you know, I have to admit, I probably wouldn't have made this commitment independently, but because we have so many, such a wide variety of perspectives on our team, Lindsay Leininger in particular, who's our CEO, what really pushed us to make a commitment to not be political, to reject politicizing facts, right? And that has been really challenging to do in a time when the facts are politicized. You know, I mean, there's a lot of ideology and a lot of politics mixed up in what has happened with the pandemic. And, but over time, you know, over these last few months, I really have come to agree with her that politicizing or you know, putting the political ideology first is the problem. We need to have the science first and then have that as the input to the policies that we're implementing. And so we really do try to just stick to the science. And at times the science reflects really badly on what has happened and how the Trump administration has handled the pandemic. And, you know, we don't come out and comment on that, but I think that, you know, it's hard to ignore that if you really look at the science, it's gone very badly from a policy perspective.
Right. Yeah. I think it's a great way of interfacing with the public, because I have noticed in my own experience with people, and this is something that's been just going on in my own social media this week, is that someone will post an article that's about elders and loneliness, right? Which is an issue we should all be concerned about right now. We should be making major policy, you know, innovations to try to support, right, these institutions that are taking care of our elders and the people who are taking care of our elders. It's a huge problem. But the way that the headline was written in this article, it sounded like, and I'm not making an assessment of the article, but it sounded like an anti-restrictions, like it's the shutdown that's causing, you know, our elders to suffer, right? And so here's something we should all be able to come together on, but we there was just an explosion on this person's social media page.
Yeah, and I think that the reason, you know, the whole the reason that that is so polarizing is because we have entered this political debate unnecessarily, this real false dichotomy, this false tension between the shutdown and the economy, right? And that's not even That's not even true. That's not even how, you know, that's not a real dichotomy. The shutdown versus the economy is not how a pandemic plays out. And the fact that that has been politicized is what makes an article like that so polarizing. You know, it's I think, a misdirect of what the real problem is, which is that here we are almost 10 months in, and we are still have no control over a pandemic in our country. And it is harming our elders and our children and our workers. And, you know, it's really destructive. And calling for a lifting of all restrictions will not fix that. You know, we need a different solution.
Yeah. I was really inspired by you talking about the difference between like thinking at the level of the individual, which is, I think, how most of us think in our daily lives. We think about ourselves and we think about our families. We think about our close-in communities, right? But thinking on the level of population is something that we're not necessarily that good at. We're actually all being kind of asked now to learn how to do that.
Yeah. I've given a ton of thought to this concept that because I'm a population scientist, and most of us are, of the collaborators, are some kind of population scientist.
Say what that is first? I mean, what is a population scientist?
Yeah. So population scientist is just, it can be interdisciplinary. There are lots of different disciplines that study populations, and demography is one of them. So is ecology. So any scientist who studies, instead of individual people or animals or whatever other individual units that make up a group, we study the group. I study populations of humans. And so I actually very rarely in my work study what's happening at the individual level. You know, I study averages and variation within those averages. And that's just a really different way of thinking about the world. And it's one that requires training, because our society, because the way we're raised, we don't get a lot of training from our parents in thinking at the population level here in the Western part of the world. And so, you know, I went to school for like many years to become a population scientist and gain that kind of perspective, where I think a lot about how one person's actions can influence another person's actions and cause sort of a chain reaction that will actually create something that's bigger than all of those individual choices, right? So, So the example of wearing masks is a really good one for this, because one person wearing a mask, it will actually make very little difference in the pandemic, right? That's it might protect them a little bit, and it might protect the people that they're sitting in front of a little bit. But if everyone wore a mask, all of those little contributions, all of those drops in the bucket would actually help tremendously. You know, much more than the sum of all those individual contributions in terms of disease transmission. One of the things that's been really striking, you know, interfacing with our readers and even many other academics from other disciplines is that a pandemic is a population problem. You know, fundamentally, that's what it is. It's not an individual problem. It's a population problem. But in order to control it, we really do need everybody to participate in control measures. And so you've got to somehow, you know, get people to do these relatively selfless acts in order to get the whole system under control and let us all go back to our normal lives.
So this is super interesting to me, because it's like, one of the things that's so beautiful about Dear Pandemic is that you are addressing the whole person. So I'm a little surprised, actually, like where you say population, I might say community, right? Because I'm not a population. Maybe I am. But anyway, but when you create your information, you include like pandemic, you know, what about pandemic fatigue? How are we going to manage our mental health this winter? What about moms and all the new, like you said, the she session, you know, of women and the double duty and all this at-home schooling and the elder care. And, you know, like this is really disproportionately impacting women. And so, like, it seems like really powerful to me because you're, even though you're not addressing on the individual level, you are addressing on kind of a holistic personal level in a way that I find really fascinating.
I have to give credit to the people who are on our team who are nurses for that point of view. That's really what they have taught me is that, you know, I think nurses have, so if I have special training in thinking at the population level, they have specialized training in taking care of an individual person, the whole person and their whole, you know, their social context, their mental health, their decision making. And so they really do. The members of our team who are nurse practitioner researchers have brought a ton of that personal perspective. And I think it does really help at the population level, because those are the kinds of things that we need people to engage in. I mean, pandemic fatigue is real. I'm absolutely sick of this. And it's very tempting especially in a place where the pandemic seems really out of control to just give up. Be like, oh, well, wouldn't it be easier if we just all got it? You know, and I can totally see how that seems easier because I feel that pressure too, but it would actually be worse if we just all got it. And so you have to, you know, fortify yourself and take those individual level actions or to keep going and keep doing the things that we need to do to protect the whole society. And, you know, you said you would maybe say community. I think historically we did think about disease outbreaks at the community level, but since this is a novel disease and because our world is now so interconnected, the community in this case is global. I mean, it's everywhere.
Yeah. We really have to think so big about how we're connected to other people.
Right.
It's kind of cool until you realize how scary it is, you know?
It would be really, really interesting if it didn't kill people, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
It's really, it is, to be honest, really interesting anyway, but it would be just plain, like, a fascinating experiment if we didn't also have to deal with this challenge of all the suffering.
Yeah, yeah, so much suffering. So I wanted to get to the part because there seems to be a synergy here, and it makes sense now that you explain that this is coming from the nurse practitioners on your team. Do you know, there's kind of a synergy between the fact that you're all nerdy girls, do you know, and it's an all-female team, and the kind of mix of science and holistic sort of well-being that, because some of the stuff, I mean, mRNA, like I just had to write that down so that I could say it back to you. Like that's, that's heavy duty science, you know,
yeah.
But then like, how are we going to get through the winter? I come to Dear Pandemic equally for both of those kinds of levels of things. And the fact that I'm coming to the same site for both actually increases my trust about both, you know? And so can you talk about the all-female nature of this and why? And
well, so it did, like the rest of it, it all started by accident. Many of us work in fields that are traditionally mostly women already. And so when we started to reach out to those members of our professional networks, they were all women. Because, I mean, I honestly, public health is very largely a female field. Many of the very senior public health people that we have been hearing in the news are male. And we immediately started to notice that. Like, I barely know any male epidemiologists. I know a couple. But it seemed like all of the ones in the news were male. And I was like, where are these guys coming from? It's just, you know, it was really striking. So when we first started reaching out to people in our professional networks, they just happened to be all women because that is who we work with. And that's who works in public health and in nursing. you know, less so in some of the more recent additions to the team. We now have people in fields that are traditionally more male, like bench science, immunology, medicine, which is changing to more female, but it, I think is still mostly male. The social scientists, you know, you do get a lot of women. So it started as an accident, and then we started to see what was happening around us, you know, men being much more heavily quoted in the news media. This is early on in March and April. And we're getting a lot of mansplaining from fields that are very male, like computer sciences and engineering, you know, people who were all those armchair epidemiologists were people they really, really tended to be white men. And so at that point, we started to lean into the fact that we were an all-female team and make it part of our, you might call it our secret mission, to lift up the voices of women and amplify each other's voices and also the voices of public health, which are mostly female. And so that is part of our secret mission.
It's fascinating to me, and I love it. And there's kind of a double layer there of kind of these ethics that have taken root within nursing and within maybe the social sciences about care, right? And then what women are still disproportionately doing at home, you know, with taking care of people. So,
yeah. And the other thing was that early on, you know, we had some professional or some personal connections too, because many of us, almost all of us, are parents. And so we were all also facing trying to, you know, being working moms was in academia was tough already. And then all of a sudden to have your kids at home, it was a real challenge. And so we had a lot of personal connection around those dual roles of caregiving and of being a working person that are very gendered in our society. And that has just become more and more clear as this has unfolded. I mean, you know, early on we had some doubts about whether we really wanted to double down on the all-female team thing. And at this point I really have no regrets. It makes for a wonderful working environment on the back end. And it's also, I think, really important that we lift up the voices of women who are being, you know, very challenged socially by what's happening.
It's intense and it's going to be long lasting, right? Because yeah. This year we're going to be living with the effects of this for a long time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that's one of the unicorn aspects seems to be that some kind of synergy around those ideas of care and the practice, not really ideas, really the practice of care. It's very inspiring. One more question. As hard as it is to imagine now, you know, someday, knock on wood, this pandemic will be over. Well, since we're heading into months before that's really our reality, I wondered if you had any advice for us. I had to ask one advice question. Any advice for us?
We are an advice column.
About managing pandemic fatigue, what do you think the one or two most important elements are?
So I can only speak from personal experience. For me, the way that I'm getting through this is by having a purpose, by having, dear pandemic, you know, it gives us all purpose. It gives us something to do that feels really important and valuable in the world. And so I can only encourage folks to find that thing that they feel gives them purpose. And sometimes that takes some real introspection, I think, to figure out exactly what that is. And, you know, I won't say dear pandemic is easy. It is often frustrating and maddening, even sometimes takes up a ton of time and energy. And I also get, you know, really tired and depressed and all of those things. But I also can always come back to it and feel that, you know, I have a contribution to make in society. And so I think the more that we can dial into what that purpose is, the better. And then the other thing that just keeps coming up from our mental health contributors, especially, is taking care of yourself. And, you know, especially those of us who have young children at home or are taking care of other people who need a lot from us, carving out some kind of time to refresh yourself is really essential to keeping going, you know, so that we don't burn out.
We've been talking to Malia Jones, and this has been a fantastic conversation. I'm so inspired by the work that you and Dear Pandemic Collective are doing. What is your motto? Stay safe, stay sane.
Stay safe, stay sane.
I'm going to take that with me. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. It was a great conversation.
You know, Nan, when you first told me about Dear Pandemic, I immediately subscribed and started to follow them on Facebook. So it was so fascinating to hear the kind of behind the scenes stories of this advice column that I've started to follow and has really become part of my daily life already. One of the most interesting parts of this interview to me was when Malia was talking about the pandemic being a population problem fundamentally, and that she's a population scientist, and those were the tools that she brought to it. And I loved the way that this was really an interdisciplinary collaboration of people from all kinds of backgrounds bringing their expertise together to provide a real service, in fact, to the public. So I thought that that part of it was really important and really a wonderful example of how we all are being forced to grow in new ways in these new circumstances that we're facing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think thinking about what does it mean to think on the level of the population? We are in such an individualistic society. And you see that all over the place. I have read the research and I don't believe this, so I'm going to have my own policy. You know, and that's not the way population science works. And a pandemic really calls us all to think at the level of population. And I thought that was really beautiful. Another thing that I think is kind of in that comment that you had is, you know, how they were really called to a kind of ethic of care, you know, and an economy of care. One of the things that I think we are going to be grappling with for a long time with this pandemic is how much the government failed to care for its people, and that mutual aid groups have stepped in, churches have stepped in, all of these different organizations have had to step into this breach of care. So here is Dear Pandemic also stepping into that breach. This is also about mental health care. It's not just what to do with your mask or what to do about spreading the virus. It's also about how do you maintain your mental health? What are we doing about women who are getting pulled out of the workforce? This is a big social issue and we need to care for it on all kinds of levels.
The part about the ethic of care, I think, is so important, and it's something that we're going to be following on college land because universities, in some ways, have been the front lines of caring for folks and caring. In fact, one of the episodes we're going to do that I'm really excited about, although it's so, I mean, disheartening at the same time, is about food insecurity, right? So universities have been had to care for their students' food needs, right? And also workers, and the ways that these new networks of mutual aid and also new ways that institutions have been forced to respond, I think are going to be really important legacies of this and really force us to think hard about the kind of community we want to be in.
Lisa, what you said about this being so generative and emerging in response to these new needs and connecting the university to this big public sphere, that's so interesting to me too. And how Malia said they didn't have a vision ahead of time. They created the unicorn of ideal public connection, right? And public engagement, but they didn't do it because they had a plan and they got a grant and they did it all, you know, according to some master plan. And that's another thing that I think is so powerful about this. This is about, you know, this is about nerdy girls, you know, nerdy people just becoming obsessed and responding to a need. And I know it took over Malia's life. And I think that's a super inspiring component of this.
Okay, kind listeners, it's time for Report Card, in which we look around the world of higher education and let you know what's awesome.
A plus.
And what's not so good.
Yep, that's enough. Sorry.
And we won't neglect the average C or B minus event if it's newsworthy. But today we have stories at the extremes. And let's start with the positive.
Okay, this story is about Virginia Posney of Manitowoc, Wisconsin, who just received her college degree from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point at age 99. Virginia grew up in Stevens Point and had started her degree way back at age 18, but then World War II interrupted her schooling. Then when her brother went off to war and the family didn't have his income, she had to go to work. So she worked at all kinds of jobs, and her family was not well off. They had to move to 20 different homes in Stevens Point over the years. Eventually, she got married and kept on working.
She loved learning. She loved reading. And so she took courses here and there when she could. And she did this over decades and decades.
So she did take those classes over decades, but she also really was committed that her children would have a college education. And she had four kids. She put them all through school, and they never paid a dime for it. And it was all based on her working those jobs. And her daughter Alexa talked about that, and she said that this wasn't something that a lot of kids did in her town. Like, it wasn't like her friends were all planning to go to college, right? This is Stevens Point, Wisconsin. It was pretty much a working class area, but in their house, it was absolutely assumed that they would go.
That education ethic. Wow. How she came to get the degree is also so sweet. She still has a really active mind at 99. She does crossword puzzles, reads 5 books a week, what? And she's an avid Green Bay Packer, Milwaukee Brewers, and Bucks fan. But you know, her daughter realized that the pandemic was getting very rough on Virginia. You know, it really has been for so many elders. She wasn't able to go out or see many people. And her daughter contacted UW Superior to ask about the number of credits that Virginia had earned over the decades. The chancellor determined that she had enough credits to earn a degree.
The chancellor came to Manitowoc, where she lives now, and they created a car parade, and her family came, and she came out onto her front porch, masked, of course, and got her college degree, and there was a much celebration.
So we give an A+ to Virginia Posney.
Okay, now for the darker side of our current reality. We give an F to the University of Vermont that this month announced that it was cutting 23 programs from the university's Arts and Sciences division to address a $9.4 million budget shortfall.
These cuts have not yet been finalized, but layoffs based on the plan have already begun. On December 14th, Jamie Williamson received his layoff notice. He's one of a few professors on campus who teaches courses in Indigenous studies. He had taught in the English department for 30 years. Instructors in history and geology also received layoff notices, and more are expected.
The draconian cuts to programs have been focused on the College of Arts and Sciences rather than spread throughout the university, and this is a point that has particularly upset faculty and students, too, at the University of Vermont.
The kinds of subjects taught in the College of Arts and Sciences include biology, chemistry, history, English, mathematics, economics, sociology, psychology. These are the core of a university, and this is where the cuts are being focused. And so this is a story that we are going to be tracking, not just at the University of Vermont, but really around the country, because what's happening at the University of Vermont is also happening elsewhere.
We're going to be breaking down budgetary issues and really investigating. The coronavirus has made budgetary issues around universities all the more urgent. But in the meantime, we want you to know that the Coalition of Faculty and Students, UVM Against the Cuts, has formed. They held a car protest just a little bit ago. Please keep watching UVM as a bellwether of what's at risk in higher ed right now.
And that's it for today's show. Stay in touch with us on Twitter at CollegeLandPod, by email, collegelandpod@gmail.com. If you've liked what you've heard, please subscribe and leave us a review so that others can find us.
Thanks to our fabulous producer, Rochelle Wilson, and to Wisconsin Humanities for their support. And let's give the final word to Virginia Posney. She said, "Get all the schooling you can. It's an asset for everybody to learn as much as you can about the world." Thanks for visiting College Land. See you next time.